Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Francesca T. Royster's book, Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions, is one of the most beautifully written music books I've ever read. It's equal parts memoir and music history. She writes intimately about being one of the few Black people to attend a country music festival in the West Loop of Chicago. Francesca admits that hearing the Lynyrd Skynyrd hit Sweet Home Alabama at this festival reminded her of all the reasons she felt wary as a Black woman entering this country music space. Francesca also introduces us to Valerie June. She describes June as a ghost catcher because of her uncanny ability to create new music that honors the past. Francesca's excited about how Black musicians are changing what country music looks and sounds like, and her excitement is contagious. She joined us from her home in Chicago.
I really became a fan once I started leaning into the book and thinking about the histories of the music. Well, I think that part of what I'm responding to is what's happening in terms of public conversations, like the ones that I hear in Recee Palmer's Color Me Country podcast, or conversations between other Black country music artists about the challenges of being in the industry that, you know, when I was participating in the Country Soul Songbook Summit that Camera Thomas organizes. So as I was working on the book in the last 5 years or so, I've really seen all of these things coming together, the music itself, new musicians, the conversations about the industry that were happening, you know, in certain venues among Black artists and music producers, and then the scholars and writers who are kind of reflecting and intervening in all of this. So it feels like a really exciting moment right now.
Mm-hmm. That's great to hear. In 1973, Tina Turner recorded the first song that she had written. It's a song called Nutbush City Limits. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I love that song. I knew it actually as a child. It's a song that I knew as part of the Ike and Tina Turner Review repertoire. But I hadn't really thought about it as autobiographical and its power in terms of really talking about, for Tina Turner, talking about her experience growing up in Tennessee, growing up in the South, and how that experience of living in the South, feeling the tensions, but also the freedoms of that landscape is really a part of her story, and a story that is shared by a lot of African Americans who have migrated from South to North. A church house, gin house, schoolhouse, outhouse, on highway number 19, the people keep the city clean, they call it Nutbush, oh Nutbush, they call it Nutbush City Limits. Nutbush City Limits, I think, is really powerful as this testimony to what it feels like sometimes to be Black in small town Tennessee during the period that she was living in, the 1940s and 50s. And also that it can have a place in popular music, which is what she and Ike did by recording it in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm. Darius Rucker, I want to ask you about Darius Rucker. He is best known as the frontman for Hootie and the Blowfish, a band that was very popular in the mid-90s. And Darius has pivoted to become a country music artist. How has this transition worked out for him?
I think he's been incredibly successful. I would say that if you asked many country music fans to name a Black artist, a contemporary Black artist, Rucker would be kind of on that list. He's probably one of the most visible mainstream country music artists. I think from his example, we really see the very narrow path of Black country music artists, especially Black country music male artists, to both demonstrate their ability to win over audiences, to be listenable and accessible, but also to be non-threatening. And in the chapter, I really thought about the song Wagon Wheel, and really the video for Wagon Wheel, as a very interesting moment where Rucker's kind of thinking he's traveling through this landscape and trying to reach a bar where he's trying to perform. And you kind of see some of the tensions that he has to go through just in terms of being interfacing with strangers, with white strangers, And there's like this interesting moment where you see him being watched. He's like watching himself being watched.
Heading down south to the land of the pines, I'm thumbing my way into North Carolina. Staring up the road and pray to God I see headlights. I made it down the coast in 17 hours, picking me a bouquet of dogwood flowers. And I'm hoping for Riley, I can see my baby tonight. So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey, mama, rock me.
And it turns out it's kind of a dream. He wakes up in the video as kind of like a take on The Wizard of Oz, where all the people who were needing to be convinced that he was a viable, a good character in the video ends up being part of his music team.
How y'all doing?
Ready,
bro? Always ready. Y'all, I just had a crazy dream, and I'll see y'all after the show.
All right. Knock them dead out there, man.
Thank you, man.
And so there's just like a very interesting way that I see Rucker dramatizing the care that it requires to be a successful Black country music artist.
As you point out, there's a strong possibility that Darius Rucker's great role model for success has been Charlie Pride.
Whenever I chance to meet some old friends on the street, they wonder how does a man get to be this way. I've always got a smiling face anytime and any place, and every time they ask me why, I just smile and say, you've got to kiss an angel good morning and let her know you think about her when you're gone.
And Charlie, of course, was the first African-American country artist associated with a major label.
When Pride first came to Nashville to start his career, he visited Music Row and, you know, had some trouble just kind of convincing people that he could be successful during this time period. And so just thinking about what was happening in terms of the United States, in terms of the South, during the civil rights moment that he was also wanting to start his career, you can kind of think about some of the pressures that he was facing. And so one of the strategies that Pride used was,
so he says, we need to come up with something. You just go in there and start singing because you done shocked them. I said, okay, what we do? He says, here's what we come up with. Ladies and gentlemen, I realize it's a little unique me coming out here on a country music show wearing this permanent sand.
So you worked on that line,
That's what we did.
In the 90s, he wrote a memoir about his life called Pride, and he really talks about what he thought about those moments, especially the moments early in his career. And he talks about feeling unsafe. He talks about, you know, his life being threatened. And he talks about experiencing a kind of racialized hazing from some of the other country music stars that he worked with, and also battling a kind of personal depression at times. So I thought it was really powerful for him at that point to expose some of the tensions of being a Black country music star. And I don't know if that book was very widely read, but I think that for someone like Darius Rucker or for Jimmy Allen or for Mickey Guyton or other contemporary artists, his example has been so important. And the extent to which he was willing to also talk about some of those troubles, maybe with them privately, was probably a really important source of solace for them too, as Guyton or especially as Rucker strategizing how to be successful as country artists.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, yeah. Let's fast forward to the 2000s when Valerie June got her music career going. Can you tell us about Valerie?
Yeah, Valerie June is so wonderful and unique as an artist because she is someone, first of all, in her voice, in her persona, she's bringing together country, rural identity, and Black identity, and claiming it. She's someone as an artist who is also really interested in the archive of past artists. And so her songwriting is really informed by earlier Black country artists and blues artists. And she also embraces what she calls her perfectly imperfect voice, which includes like cracks and, you know, is kind of nasal and is like kind of an everyday, beautiful everyday voice that she says is like the voices that she used to hear when she'd go to church.
Dancing on the astral plane, holy water cleansing rain, floating through the stratosphere, brought me here, you see, so clear. Is there a way for you to shine out fear?
Her work is so interesting because there's a kind of hominess that's connected to the past, but she's also really interested in imagining futures, and there's a really strong kind of Afrofuturistic kind of utopian aspect to her songs, kind of includes psychedelic sounds and kind of free jazz sounds sometimes in her music.
The banjo has played a very important role in the history of African American music, and the Grammy and MacArthur Award winner Rhiannon Giddens has played a huge role in spreading the word about the banjo. What exactly has she done?
She's so amazing. She's always thinking about how to explore past music forms like the banjo and really connecting them to African American history and lives, and how to also think about how music is an important force for connecting communities. And I think that's something she does with her Silk Road project. But I appreciate that she often plays a minstrel banjo, which is a banjo that has kind of a lower kind of tenor sound that's based on the banjos that were used in 19th century minstrel shows to kind of get us to hear and rehear the banjo and to think about this history of blackface minstrelsy and the ways that it's shaped popular music and also kind of contributed in some ways to the marginalization of black creativity. So she was reclaiming the banjo and also using it to talk about black history and stories, as she does really well on Songs of Our Native Daughters, where she's taking on stories about enslaved lives, or thinking about the commodification of bodies now, or thinking about the ways that we seek spiritual resilience from the ancestors in her song Music and Joy. All of her music, I think, is very healing and also really informed by a difficult history. And she, through her powerful music and her beautiful voice, she kind of helps us to face a history that's sometimes really painful and to heal and connect to others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. Let's talk about Lil Nas X's 2018 hit, Old Town Road. You've identified 13 ways of looking at the song. My favorite way is number 13 on the school bus. Can you tell us about this way?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to have at least some part of the book that's really thinking about how my daughter, Cece, is so much a part of my enjoyment of Lil Nas X and of Black country music in general. And so on the school bus, I was really thinking about how Cece and her friends loved Old Town Road and loved singing it with each other. And I imagined a school field trip where they're singing on the school bus, which Cece said they actually did. And just thinking about the power of that song to connect this very diverse group of kids and the humor and just accessibility of the song. And to me, it was like, it's testimony of how Old Town Road was so infectious for so many people.
Can't nobody tell me nothing. You can't tell me nothing.
In my writing about it, I was really also thinking about that line, can't nobody tell me nothing, as just like this really fun but also resistant spirit that informs the whole song and might be one reason that I think Old Town Road is important for this younger generation, both as a way of kind of giving them a way to be resistant and to connect with each other, but also provide an example of enjoying country music in a way that isn't segregated or doesn't perpetuate the idea that this isn't your music. This can be anybody's music.
Hmm. How do you see Black country music evolving?
I think that what's so exciting to me is the ways that current Black country music artists are working together. I think there's a kind of collectivity that and collaboration that I think can change the form. And I'm thinking that whatever else happens in terms of the popularity of bringing Black country music to mainstream audiences like the Grand Ole Opry or the Country Music Association Awards, that these kinds of collaborations are going to push country music as an industry. Black artists and also of other artists, ally artists like Brandi Carlile or others who are really working to create a more permanent place for Black artists. And I think that that will necessarily also change the way that country music sounds like in exciting ways. The sound of country can also include this rootedness that I hear in the music that I've looked at.
Mm, yeah, that would be great. Francesca T. Royster, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions. It's a beautifully written and very captivating book.
Thank you so much, Doug. I really enjoyed talking to you about it.
Francesca T. Royster is the author of Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions. Find out more about Francesca and her book at wpr.org/beta.
And so she took on these male pseudonyms for different pieces of her writing, so it didn't look like she dominated the magazine.
Coming up, Tracy Dawson introduces us to historical women who refused to take no for an answer. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.